Hi, welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori.
So today we are, we're just going to give, we're kind of doing a recap episode. We feel a little bit like we're 50-something episodes in and 1 million downloads.
1 million people. 1 million. And I also was looking today, I don't think I told you this, at the analytics, and it said that the average listen time is like 50-something minutes, which means people are sticking with this too, which is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Because we do. We talk a lot.
We do talk a lot. We do.
Got a lot of words.
We also edit a lot. Well, you edit a lot. Yeah. I edit zero things. I'm like the diva that just walks in like, are we ready? No, mostly because I don't know how. So props to you. But since we are this many episodes in, we felt like just kind of a recap, high level. Here's a summary of the whole story was a little bit needed because
I also feel like when we started out, we were so careful and we kind of talked around stuff because of all the things. And now we can be a little bit just more clear and concise.
Yeah, absolutely.
So people have kind of, that's been a little bit of the feedback we've gotten is that some of the early episodes are a little bit convoluted.
Yeah, we also just didn't know what we were doing. Like we decided to start a podcast and that was like definitely the right decision. But we were not sure exactly how to create that content in a way that would make an impact, but also not, you know, re-victimize me and reopen boxes and, you know, just all the things. So we've come a very long way from those episodes. But because of that, we feel the need to kind of go back and just like, okay, here's the high level. We also have a lot of new people kind of jumping into this with us in the recent weeks as we kind of make strides towards being even more public than we are. We kind of foresee that happening even more. So again, we want to have a place to have people just, you know, hey, if you're just looking to hear the high level story, the summary, go to this episode. We still need to number our episodes.
Right. I started doing that. I think I got through a lot. I started too.
Oh, good for you. So. I didn't even notice.
That's why I'm the editor.
Anyways, okay, so high level, I'm Kate, and I am a survivor of family-controlled trafficking. My abuse started really even before I was born, or the story starts, I guess, before I was even born. The situation is intergenerational, meaning that technically things began with my parents and their trauma. My grandparents, my father's parents, were involved in a church in which, the pastor and his children were also offenders. Lots and lots of teachings in that church that kind of lends itself to these things happening.
So the trickle down was just somewhat inevitable.
Oh, absolutely. My grandfather not only sexually abused me, but he also abused my dad's sister, you know, so yeah,
that we know of.
That we
know
of, right?
The other sister or the brothers. We don't know.
Absolutely.
So there are technically four children in your family?
Four children, yep. My dad is the firstborn boy, which, again, in this type of abuse that has significance, that has meaning, any type of firstborn male, you know, is kind of held to this.
There's a status.
Yeah, there's a status, definitely on a pedestal. So the torch, so to speak, was passed to my dad. My father was in business with my grandfather when he was young, and then ultimately my father took over the business and my dad's youngest brother bought into it with him. So that's their Bright World business. We talk a lot about the Bright World versus the Dark World. Dark World is the abuse, the trafficking, the profits that were being made from that. And the Bright World is their like
regular life.
Regular
front
life.
Facing.
Yeah, front facing things. So yeah, the grooming of my abuse took place very early. I was, as early as four, probably earlier, but I can't really speak to what I don't remember. So my earliest memories are about 4 years old. It was happening with my father, my grandfather, and my uncle, who were all sexually abusing me.
Your uncle, who was the husband of the aunt we know who was abused.
Right. Because unfortunately, statistics tell us that women who are abused often marry men like their abuser. Thankfully, I did not.
Yes.
Okay. Later, the grooming became more like practice or training for the things that people were ultimately going to pay for. Early in the abuse, again, starting as early as four, it was family that was abusing me. It was friends of my family, my father's close friends. So he had a circle of friends from church. They all grew up together, and many of those men were involved in the abuse, again, very early on. Yes. When I was around 7 years old, my father's legitimate Bright World business, which was an auto repair shop, was struggling. They declared bankruptcy and had to change the name of the shop, and it was a whole financial disaster. At that point, my parents had a conversation with me about the business being in trouble. The conversation was, it's your responsibility to fix that. You know, again, as a seven-year-old, I'm hearing my parents say to me, we will lose everything. You are going to lose everything. You will lose your house. You will lose your bedroom, your blankets, your stuffed animals, all the things, if you don't fix this. I had already been kind of programmed for, you know, with the early grooming, this is what you were born for, that you are here to, you know, please these men.
Which is just a terrible thing to say. So yeah. I'm sorry, but I just had to.
My father and I, you know, he very much was, this is a special relationship. You have to do these things. If you love me, you'll do these things for me. But then also on the flip side of that was, you're bad and that's why these things happen. So it just depended on the circumstance. If I was in trouble, then it was, these things are happening to you because you're bad. And if I wasn't in trouble, then it's, if you love me, you know, and we're special to each other, then you will do these things.
The agenda was also to keep you so turned around that there was no chance that you were ever going to consider telling.
Oh yeah. No, I didn't know which way was up. There did come a point in which other children were also being hurt and involved. I was shown pictures of these other kids being sexually abused. I was also told about them. I witnessed some of it. And basically the message was, if you don't do this, then these kids will have to. So that was, a really hard thing.
And another way that, again, they kept you trapped.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they were people that I cared about. They were not just like random kids, you know, pictures that they had gotten from who knows where. These were people that I knew. These were, you know, friends of mine or
people from the Bright
World. People from the Bright World. Yeah. So, yeah.
And they made you feel like whatever bad would happen to them was your fault.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Also, just in terms of pictures being taken, video being taken, both pictures and video were taken of the abuse. Again, this is the 90s, so we're talking about Polaroid cameras, actual video VHS cameras, you know, being used. We're not talking about digital. This is not the digital world at this point. This is not like the internet or anything like that. This is like a legitimate Polaroid picture of my friend from church that I'm now seeing, you know, abuse happening in this picture.
And it is understood, it has come back to us, and you've said it before, but that your father had a Polaroid camera collection and a dark room in his basement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was developing his own film.
Right.
The abuse, you know, again, after this 7-year-old mark, became really more clearly like trafficking. The trafficking element is kind of where this came in. Money changed hands. I was told what was expected. I was told what a person was paying for. I wasn't usually told how much they were paying, but I understood that there were specific acts or specific people that they were paying a high price for what was about to happen. And so I needed to make sure I did it right. So I did have an understanding of the money changing hands. I saw envelopes that would change hands. So yeah, lots and lots of that. Okay.
It's hard to do this.
This is very hard.
Breath.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay.
Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, no, it's just, it's like I'm high leveling, like, oh, let me just give you a quick rundown. But like, this is also my real life. And these things actually happened to me. And it's like I'm walking on the edges of the boxes, like I've said before.
I was going to say.
It's like mental gymnastics, because it's like I'm trying to tell the story in a coherent, cohesive way that people can hear and understand. But it's like opening the boxes in my brain, but and like looking so that I can give the story and I can accurately, you know, recount the experience, but not falling so far into the box that I can't keep going or can't be done.
Okay. So I know we didn't even talk about saying this, but why do this? Like, people who are just coming in are maybe like, well, great. So if it's so hard, why on earth are you doing it?
Yeah.
Great question.
Yeah. Why are we doing any of this? I guess that's the thing, right? The podcast was born out of a place of desperation. Unfortunately, you know, while the physical sexual abuse has stopped, the mental them mentally tormenting me and stalking me and leaving threats has not, and really had not before the podcast. And so it started there, and now it's really at a place of still that strength in numbers, right? The more people that hear the story, the more people that know who these people are, that know the story, the better protected I am, my kids are. Again, strength in numbers is what we keep saying. But also that this happens, right? This is not a me thing. This is not an uncommon, like, oh my gosh, this one girl in all of the world these things happen to. This is like 40% of all trafficking victims are trafficked by a family member or a caregiver. So this is not a me thing. This is something that people need to be aware of, because there's a really good chance that you might come across somebody in your world or know somebody in your life that needs help getting out. And what we know from talking to many other survivors on this journey is that what I have been experiencing with the threats and the manipulation and the mental torment is not uncommon. These people do not let their victims just age out and go on with their life. It's not a thing. So again, you might have someone in your life who's struggling with that, and you might not recognize what exactly it is. And you might be tempted to call it stalking, or you might be tempted to call it harassment, but really it's this. But this is also really hard to just blurt out and tell somebody. So it's the awareness piece as well.
I think we've also found that there has been so much information coming to us since the start of the podcast that has just, I think, compelled us forward, because it's like, yes, there it is. There is all of the background. There is another survivor that was entangled in this. There is another person who is a bystander who saw it, who didn't know what to do or was complicit. There's so much information that I think brought us past the point of desperation to a point of power and voice, and that this is a chance to help other survivors as well, and also to grow a community that can show up well for survivors.
No, absolutely. Yeah, we keep saying, you know, we're cultivating an army of people who are well-educated, well-resourced, and know what to do.
Right. So they're not shocked.
No.
We've had people come to us and say, now I know. And mm-hmm. now a lot of people are like, now I know. So if someone comes to me and says this stuff, I'm at least going to be prepared to react in a way that's helpful. And we've also had people come and say, I have had to be that person. And because of the podcast, I was able to hear this and not be blown away.
Yes.
That's why.
Yeah.
For your safety and for the safety of others.
Yep. Definitely. Okay, so back to the timeline. So how did they get and keep my compliance? So loyalty and sort of this twisted version of love, like I said before, if you love me, you'll do these things for me. There was lots of threats of them hurting themselves, like my dad, you know, threatening to take his own life if I didn't do these things. And so again, if you think about it from a 7, 8, 9-year-old perspective. Kids love their parents. I don't know. You can speak to that.
I mean, we understand that. And even if they are extremely abusive, kids tend to believe it's their fault, and they're always trying to find a way to repair and fix and make it what it was meant to be, a healthy relationship.
Yeah. So, yeah. So from the perspective of, like I said, a kid, you know, I was terrified that he would actually do that. And so it was like, no, please don't do that. I'll do it. I'll do whatever you ask. There was also this fear of fate worse than death, which I've said a few times in the podcast that I, especially in those middle years, when things were really bad, I could have only hoped that they would have just ended my life, because truthfully what was happening, the very sadistic nature of the abuse was, death would have been merciful, honestly. Okay. There was also the threat of, we will just make you disappear into the dark world and no one will ever see you again. So again, that idea that it could actually be worse. It could actually be no bright world, no school, no friends, no anything, just this all day, every day, was kind of the threat. They also, like I said before about people, other children, if you don't do this, this girl will have to, or if you don't, we'll kill or hurt somebody that you love. Anytime anyone tried to get close to me, that was the threat, was, you know, if you tell, we'll hurt that person, which, was equally as trapped of a feeling.
Because it was also, and that will be your fault. That was
their message. Right. Right.
They're going to get hurt because you wouldn't do what you were told.
Yeah. Honestly, I still battle that narrative, right? Of just feeling like I don't, yeah, I feel like just circumstances of late and, you know.
You ask me regularly, am I hurting you?
Yeah, because, yeah, this is hard. What we're doing is really hard. And I'm thankful that you're in this with me and holding the middle. But, you know, there's that part of me that's like, I'm sorry that you are. I'm sorry you ever met me because.
But I'm not. So. Just saying publicly, yeah. But I'm not.
Yeah. Okay.
They also kept you very isolated, though. So you did not have many opportunities
No. To
meet your person who might be able to help you be free.
No. And my extracurricular, like, places where I would be able to do that were very strictly controlled by them. So Christian school, church, you know, where honestly church is such a difficult thing anyways, because I think we all can understand that there's a lot of churches that have a lot of problems with sexual abuse disclosures and just kind of not believing women, not believing girls, covering it up, making it go away. So, yeah, it was just a, you know, and also that whole like, well, he repented, so forgive and forget. There's a lot to say about the church element, but that was like where I was at. So who was I going to tell, you know? Mm-hmm. Plus, a lot of these men and offenders were also church members at my church. So again, who was I going to tell?
So not only who are you going to tell because you were entrenched in that world, but who are you going to tell because church people didn't feel safe?
Right. No.
Why would
they? Not at all. Yeah. No. Church was not a safe place for me.
But yet you tried to tell.
Yeah. So my first escape attempt was in middle school. I was in seventh grade. I had attempted to commit suicide. Very, very unsuccessfully. I had told a friend about it, as well as had some bruising around my neck from the attempt. And a teacher had intercepted the note that I had written to a friend, you know, indicating that I was going to try again, basically, and had also noticed some things that were off and just noticed my behavior. And I started asking questions, and I did confide in this teacher that my father was sexually abusing me actively, like current present day. I had told her, and you know, that this was happening in my home. She spent months talking to me about these things and talking to me about what that felt like and what was going on. I continued to confide in her. She did not call the authorities. She did not intercede really at all in that.
Until
it all kind of came to a head. I had to go to a snow camp situation with school, and I, right before snow camp, was really horribly injured due to a abuse experience. And so at snow camp, I was just like incapable of participating in all the stupid events. So a parent who was a chaperone on the trip asked questions, right? She noticed I wasn't okay. She noticed I wasn't participating. She noticed that I was alone a lot and just kind of not interacting. And she started asking questions. And after a very heated, emotionally charged chapel session at snow camp, she pulled me aside and I broke down and told her that my father was sexually abusing me and that I was injured from this. We got back to school, and the next Monday at school, I get called down to the principal's office, and instead of the school, so the parent who I disclosed to on the trip had brought the information to the school. The teacher that I had already been confiding in was there, and instead of the school contacting CPS or the authorities, they called my parents. So I got called on to the principal's office and my parents walked down the hallway, and I am now sitting as a seventh grader. So I'm 12 years old, sitting in a conference room across the table from my dad, who was my abuser and trafficker. And basically I'm being asked to confront him or retract. I was 12. I couldn't confront him.
Of course you couldn't.
So I very quickly was like, I'm sorry. It wasn't my dad. It was my uncle, which was also not a lie. My uncle was an abuser of mine. He had recently, at this point, moved to Minnesota. So it was kind of an easy shift of, well, he's not here anymore, so it's okay. and yeah, the months following that disclosure were absolutely horrific. The abuse became very violent. I mean, it was already violent, but it was really like stepped up. My father completely, he just wouldn't speak to me unless he was abusing me. My mother also blamed me, just generally hated me for a really long time. I was made to, again, I'm 12 years old, and I was made to apologize to my teachers as well as to my entire class, my friends at school, and basically admit that I was a liar and I was dramatic. So
that was a disaster of an escape attempt, not yeah. because you failed, but because the adults failed.
Yeah. So again, because I had then pivoted and named my uncle, really to just avoid, you know, confronting my dad, instead of calling the authorities, my parents flew me out with them. So it was me, my mom, my dad, flew out to Minnesota, to confront, quote, my uncle.
That was the forward facing story.
Right. Yeah. The public story was, we're flying out to Minnesota. It's biblical to confront those that have hurt you. And so Kate is going to come and we're going to confront him and say, you did these things. The real thing, though, the real story is basically we flew out there so that he could then also inflict the consequences that were coming for telling. So that's that escape attempt. yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Moving forward. In high school, I didn't even actually mean to tell. Again, the public story was, my uncle sexually abused me from this age to this age. It's fine now. He lives in Minnesota, and forgive and forget. And we're just going to pretend like it didn't happen. Oh, Kate doesn't want to talk about it with anybody because, you know, abuse, we don't talk about it. And so just keep living your life. Also, she's a liar and she's dramatic, so nobody should really talk to her about anything ever. So that was my life for a little while. Oh, and by the way, abuse is still very, very much happening.
So from 12 to about 15, which is the next escape attempt, was about 15?
16, 17, yeah.
Okay.
So for this, I didn't even really mean to tell. My grandfather had passed away. And again, like I said, this is intergenerational. It started way before I was even born. And all of his activities in this and in this kind of ritualistic sexual abuse zone, a lot of the offenders came into town to sort of memorialize that.
Which we say just so matter-of-factly, but again, we're just trying to high-level this here, but I don't want to just ignore the fact that this is a lot, what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's not for you to be saying. So that meant weeks and weeks of abuse from lots of people.
Yeah.
And you not very much not being okay.
Yeah.
And then, as I understand it, you went to work.
Yeah. So I went to work. I was working at Tim Hortons. Ooh. If you don't live in Western New York or Canada, you don't know what that is, but it's great.
Coffee.
Yeah. I wasn't okay. A friend, she noticed, she asked me what was going on. And just like in middle school, I kind of had a moment of just breaking down and told her.
Told her what?
That I had been assaulted. My uncle. So yeah, it's like I'm only able to tell a piece of what actually happened because the first escape attempt was so terrible that it was like, I'm going to tell you the most minimal amount of information so that I can maybe get help, but I don't even know. But also not untrue. Like that's, I think, the important thing is that like that was not, it was just a piece of the bigger puzzle. But it wasn't an untrue piece. It's not like I lied about my uncle. He came into town. He did assault me. He was part of that whole ritualistic craziness and horrible abuse that happened. But was it just him? No. But that's the part that was...
It was already out there, so it felt slightly
less
risky.
Yeah, it was like he came and he did these things. And so, yeah, it was a little bit less risky.
So then again, what went wrong?
So my friend told her mom... this is a friend from work/school, so this is not like a controlled narrative, right? My parents couldn't really do anything about it. Yeah, it was out in the public. I was in a public high school at this point. So my friend's mother called my mother because, again, if a child comes to you and says that this happened and they're not naming the parents as the abusers, what is the first thing that people are going to do? Call the parents. Right. So that makes a ton of sense, but that also is the most detrimental thing that anybody could have done. Because though it was kind of outside of their sphere of influence, my parents were kind of forced to call the police. They would have looked like really, really crappy parents if they didn't at this point, because it was becoming more widespread and known and, you know, how could you let this happen again? Kind of. So for their own self-preservation and self-image, they decided, okay, we're going to file a police report. However, I grew up on a very, very small island, literally an island in the middle of Western New York. And the police department that kind of oversees the island, my father was friends with many, many of the police officers. His auto repair shop did a lot of work on several law enforcement agencies, like work vehicles. They called the police, but like they called his friend who was a police officer.
So basically there was an investigation. It didn't dive very deep and ultimately it was focused on David.
Right.
Not your parents.
Right.
They didn't interview without your parents present.
Right. Yeah, no, my parents were sitting at the table during the interview. It was my dad's friend who came. I was never alone. I did go to a child advocacy center for an interview at one point. But again, I was reassured by the detective that my parents were on the other side of the glass. It was kind of like, don't worry, it's okay. Your parents are right on the other side of the glass. Again, that's couldn't have been a worse thing to say. But because I was naming my uncle, he didn't know that. So the police report was filed. There's really no end. We've seen the police report. It's kind of like, oh, we referred it out to a detective in Minnesota and it didn't really end. It just was nothing.
And again, remembering because your parents were kind of the front, they were the in between you and you were 17, you weren't an adult yet. And so the contact would have been between the detective and your parent.
Right, absolutely.
And
yeah, the entire police report that we've read, which honestly, when I did get a copy of that, I was a little bit blown away by Because I only heard what my parents relayed to me. So it was whatever their spin of the narrative was. So reading it in black and white was a little bit like, just, wow, I just didn't know
that that's what was going on.
That was, yeah. And, but a lot of it is father states. They told the detective to come back another day, that I wasn't ready to talk to him, which, you know, yeah, there's just so much to be said about that whole experience. Okay, biblical counseling. So after both escape attempts, I was forced to go to biblical counseling.
So what was the focus of that counseling, that and the earlier counseling?
Yeah, so the entire thing was forgive and forget. Basically, we don't talk about it. You know, to bring it up is basically like you're sinning. And you need to just forgive your parents. You need to forgive David. You need to forgive everybody and never, ever, ever talk about it. Forget it even happened. You'll never heal and you'll never be worth anything if you just keep talking about this. So very much drilled into me that this was just had to be kind of pushed under the rug. And that was that. After high school, I went to Liberty University. If you don't know about Liberty, Google it. They are currently facing several Title IX lawsuits for mishandling sexual abuse cases.
And so when you were, they followed you, the abuse and trafficking followed you to Virginia.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, go back and listen to those episodes. But Liberty wasn't a choice. I wasn't like, I didn't go on like college campus tours and like see what was out there. I went on a college campus tour of Liberty University, and was basically told like, this is where you're going. And that was that. So much to say about Liberty, but go listen to that
college
episode.
Years episode. Yeah. Right. But the abuse followed you.
Yep.
And then when you were not okay and a friend noticed, what happened?
So once again, I broke down, told a friend that I had been assaulted, following an abuse experience in which a man had paid for the things to happen. And of course she kind of panicked and took me to the emergency room. I wouldn't let anybody touch me. I was terrified because I knew that I shouldn't be at the emergency room. I shouldn't be telling anybody. I shouldn't be doing any of the things that I was doing that had been quite drilled into me. But I ended up leaving the hospital AMA after talking with my father, which, again, is noted in the hospital record that I was on the phone with him and then decided to leave AMA. So Lynchburg Police Department, because I lived on campus, it was actually jurisdictionally under Liberty University's police department. Yes, they have their own police department, which is terrifying for everybody. But so Liberty Police ended up taking the case. Again, I wasn't able to tell the entire story. It was like, I was able to tell a little bit about the assault, but it was, again, I was on the phone with my dad constantly, him spinning a certain kind of story that was supposed to work, right? And it wasn't working. It was kind of like this very PC thing because it wasn't the whole story. And at the end of it all, they basically said that, you know, I was lying and that the assault was consensual. And because consensual sex before marriage is against the Liberty way, that I was now going to be expelled. So.
Although you were physically injured. That's why you're
physically
noticed.
Injured. Yeah. But it was, you know, consensual. Right. They decided it was consensual and therefore I would be expelled for having sex before marriage.
Until what?
Until the Dean of Women called my father and then called me. And all of a sudden, the entire story was, it's fine. You can stay. I have no idea what that conversation entailed. But what I do know is that I was packing to leave to be expelled. The next thing I know, she called my father. And the next thing I know, I can stay. The only stipulation was that I had to go again to mandatory biblical counseling, which again was, why are you such a liar? Why would you have sex before marriage? Why are you such a sinner? And you really need to examine you. So I came home from Liberty after I stayed at Liberty for a little while, and then I did a semester in Washington, D.C. I met my husband and started dating him. And so I moved back home actually to finish my degree online. The harassment and the threats kind of always continued. It's always been a part of my life. I very much blocked it out for a long time. I got married. I had kids. I put all of that in a box and put it in the back of my brain and just thought, I'm not going to deal with that anymore. I'm just going to.
I have my life. I tried to get out how many times and it didn't work.
Yeah, so. There's no point. So I got married. I had my precious babies. And I just wasn't going to deal with it. It was just in a box. It was a whole separate part of me. I had my daughter in 2016 and my entire brain collapsed. I took one look at her and just knew that I couldn't do this. All of the boxes started to open and I wasn't sleeping. I would literally watch her sleep and be convinced that she would just stop breathing. I was so sure that was going to happen. So I started talking to a friend. I was, you know, she had noticed again that I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I wasn't okay. And so I started kind of talking with her about those things, and she recommended that I see someone, that I get help, which honestly, it's unbelievable that I even ever sought you out because
right.
My experience of counseling had been so bad. It's really taken me almost as long to even say that word because it was such a derogatory, like negative connotation in my mind.
I had a beast tied to it.
Yeah, it was so bad. Safe? I mean, even now I would prefer to say it's therapy because I just don't like that term. But so I did reach out for some help, and I started kind of disclosing to Lori the same way that I always had. My uncle this one time is probably fine, but also I have a daughter and I'm like not sleeping. So like help, right?
That's pretty much. How it almost always starts, with a toe dipped in the water. But yeah. That's how it started.
Yeah.
But
then ultimately, yeah, telling you all of it, and kind of the further we got into it and the more that I could see that you were trustworthy, being able to say, I mean, I actually remember the day when I said to you, men paid for these things that happened. And I didn't even know how to like articulate that better. Like I felt like I wanted to have better words for it, but it was just like, blah, like I just have to like throw it up on the table and be like, just so you know, like, that's what happened. And that kind of, you being able to hold that information kind of then opened the door to telling you about what that really looked like.
Which is part of why we are going to continue what we're doing, because we want to equip other people to be able to show up and hold space for some of those really hard things.
Yes.
Because you'd had experiences where there wasn't enough space.
Right. No, absolutely.
So then we kept working through and working through and working through, and eventually got to a place where it was evident that you needed to have a conversation and set some boundaries with your parents.
Yeah, absolutely. The more we kind of unpacked and the more that I was willing to face, the more clear it became to me that they needed to be distant at best from my life. Mm-hmm. And from my kids, right? It was really all of this, all of seeking out help and all of this was because of my children, because I could not live with myself having the generational thing continue. It had to stop with me and with them. And so it came to a point where it was like, okay, this has to change. I asked my brother for help in that. So summer, fall-ish timeframe of 2019, I started talking to my brother. We had some kind of aha moments with each other of just like, oh yeah, like that tracks, kind of moments. He, with my sister-in-law, my husband, and Lori, we met with my parents. At this point, really just setting boundaries. I wasn't ready to fully disengage or to go no contact, mostly because I was terrified of what that looked like.
Because anytime you had tried to say no before to anything.
Yeah, it was so much worse. So
November 2019, we have this meeting and the result of that was
terrible. Just absolutely terrible. They
did everything they could to shut it down, to discredit you, to blame you, to guilt you.
Yeah.
Ultimately, because they were completely unwilling to try to work through anything,
Right.
It was no contact.
So we ended up going no contact, even though I wasn't really ready for that, but I kind of had to get ready for it because they did that. So, and honestly, like once we did that, it was like, okay, there's no going back. Like, it was terrifying because there was no fallback. There was no like crawling back to them and saying, I'm sorry. Like, it was just, this was it. And that was super, super scary because that had always been my, you know, thing.
So in January of 2020, I made contact with somebody who was the counseling pastor from the church where Kate's parents attended and where Kate's mother was, ready, a biblical counselor who was counseling women through some sexual abuse as well as other things. I made contact with them to basically say, so you already know that this whole thing between the parents and Kate is going on. Please hear me say that this woman should not be counseling anyone. Surely you must know that. The response was basically, stay in your lane.
Like, yeah.
That's, I will handle that.
Yeah.
And from not long after that, we were in contact with law enforcement and working through that process as well.
Not because of the trafficking, though, because of the threats.
Right.
They really never investigated that. It was,
no.
Yeah.
Right.
So then, yeah, in January of 2022, after kind of going back and forth and giving all this information to the chapel and to, you know, just, yeah, going back and forth, the counseling pastor stood up on stage in front of thousands and thousands of people. And
knowing that Kate's parents had been accused of trafficking her.
Yeah. And stated that he was so thankful to be in community with Ron and Wendy Cook, my parents. So that is how the podcast was born.
Right. This was not just a, yes, we were infuriated and disgusted that someone would feel that way. Never mind say it. Right. So we did eventually get an apology from him, but the apology was, I'm sorry I said that.
Mm-hmm.
Not I'm sorry that
actually,
I felt that way.
The first apology was I'm sorry you heard me say that. Not I'm sorry I said it. It was, I didn't expect that you would be listening.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
No, it was, the podcast was not, I think where you're going with this, right. It was not a form of revenge or anything like that. It was desperation because once that happened, he emboldened them. Just like every other time that the escape attempts failed, when Liberty University said, oh, okay, we think it was consensual and now it's your fault, it emboldens them to do more things and to just continue on with what they're doing.
Because they came back to you after the failed escape attempts, and what was the message?
We told you. We told you that you would never get out. We told you that this was what you were born for and you will never, ever, ever.
No one will believe you.
No one will believe you. Right.
And so he stood up there and said those things. And so it was more panic than it was vindictiveness.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And because we were getting threats and because the threats were continuing and because the day that that happened, I got this horrific threat, you know. So the podcast was born out of just sheer desperation. So that is, I think, where we're going to stop for our high-level overview.
I just want to add one piece.
Yeah.
As soon as the podcast came out, we started getting messages from people with corroborating information, as well as local church leaders saying, oh, my word. Now we are worried about who might be in our building that we have to be worried about.
Right.
And they were asking us to help them figure that out, which, of course, we very much care about people being safe. And so that began a journey of us trying to figure out, okay, how on earth do we now manage the safety concern for others as well as safety concern for you?
Right. Yeah.
So that is the high level.
That's,
and of course, the journey continues, which, you know, I don't know. This was meant to be an opportunity for people to get a summary of the whole of what the podcast is about. So if you want more details about any of these topics, please go back and listen to the episode that correlates and stay tuned because there's plenty more to come.
Yep, definitely. Thanks for listening.